right, welcome back to the John Curley, Sherry Elliker radio experience, now in 3D. Does anybody know where John Curley is, by the way? What is John doing? And why doesn't he return my phone calls or my letters? What's going on? Jacob?
I believe he's at another auction. I'm not sure where.
John Curley at an auction? What is this? What is it? Is he buying stuff or what is he doing?
But
I'm kidding. Do we know where he is auctioning?
I do.
Oh, if Sherry wants to share, that's yeah.
I'll just say he's west of Seattle. How do you like that?
Wow.
Yeah.
West. I'll also say if his if you're writing him letters, Jack, I don't think he can barely handle text messages,
yeah.
And those he dictates to his phone. So I don't think the letters are really gonna.
Yeah,
I don't think it's the best way to reach him.
Breaking news: John Curley never learned how to read. All right, where are we going with this? Can we talk about the Dave Chappelle thing really quick before we get to this Carnival Cruise? Just kind of mix it up a little bit. Sherry, you good
with
that?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So I think everybody knows what happened to Dave Chappelle. He was at the Hollywood Bowl and he was participating in the Netflix Is Not a Joke comedy festival. Earthquake was there along with Mos Def, aka Yasin Bey, and a bunch of other people. Sherry, I'm sure you're very familiar with all the cast of characters that were there. Black Star was there, Talib Kweli, all these guys that you listen to on a regular basis, right?
Right. And in the front row, Elon Musk was there.
Ooh,
so,
wow.
Yeah, it was really a kind of a star-studded event.
So then a sociopath who is brandishing a weapon that is a fake gun that has a real knife attached to the front of it, kind of like the weapons from Final Fantasy VIII, if anybody understands that deep cut reference. Andrew, did you get that reference?
I don't think so.
You are wow, making me so mad today, Andrew. Okay, someone out there has to know what I'm talking about. Final Fantasy VIII, look it up. It's like a gun and then a knife that it's attached to the end of the gun. Right, Sherry?
Yeah, and it's sort of a curiosity how he got the gun and the knife through the metal detectors. But yes, it was a fake gun, but the knife was attached to it.
And so he runs up on stage, tackles Dave Chappelle, and Dave Chappelle has more security than the president of the United States. So it did not go very well for him. His name is Isaiah Lee, I believe his name is.
Yes, and he himself is a rapper.
He did
a couple of rap songs, one about Dave Chappelle. He did another one about Aflac, the insurance company, which I'm sure was a really, I can't believe we haven't all been, dancing to that. So
very topical. Aflac.
Yeah.
What is this, 2006? who uses Aflac as insurance? Proud sponsors, by the way.
Yeah. So he was a budding rapper or something like that. Nobody seems to know at this point what his motivation or why he decided to attack him. He had done this rap song about Dave Chappelle about 2 years ago, but who knows? It's just weird.
Okay, so then what happens is all of Dave Chappelle's security guards, of which he has many, swarm this guy, and they really did a number on this guy. I mean, his arm was pivoted in such a way that I didn't think it was humanly possible for an arm to be bent forward at a 45-degree angle. He almost looks like a fledgling bird learning how to fly. You know what I'm talking about, Sherry? Like one of the... doesn't have the rhythm quite down yet, but his arm is like in front of him when it should be behind him.
I have I'm double jointed.
Oh,
and I can kind of pop my arm out like that, my elbow.
Right.
It looks a lot like that. I mean, it's so awful. And it wasn't just Dave Chappelle's security detail that did the beatdown. It was anybody, they were taking anybody that wanted to get up there and throw a punch or a stomp or whatever. I mean, it was like just mayhem.
Yeah. So I said this last night on my highly rated, critically acclaimed, much beloved radio program between 7 and 10 p.m. I said that it is very interesting to notice the difference between when a nobody attacks a somebody and when a somebody attacks a somebody. And what I mean by that. that is that last month we all watched Will Smith walk up on stage and strike a man in the face and then turn around and do the Jefferson walk all the way back down to his seat. And nobody did anything. Nobody politely asked him to leave. Chris Rock said, I don't want to press charges. Later on, the district attorney said that they weren't going to press charges. And that's because we have two somebodies. But when a nobody attacks a somebody, look at how fast the law moves in. He's got felony assault charges. The backlash against it has been tremendous. And I just think it goes to show or demonstrate that we do have what some people might refer to as a two-tiered justice system in society. But I don't think it has so much to do with ethnicity as much as people might like to say that, as much as it has to do with status. I'm going to take a little bit more of a different turn on this, that the DA, if they had so chosen, could have pressed charges in Los Angeles against Will Smith, and they chose not to. They said, no, we don't want to do it, which is bizarre to me because we have Will Smith on film literally committing a crime. He is assaulting somebody on film in front of millions of people. And yet we have the same thing with Isaiah Lee, and instantly he gets felony charges. Really interesting to see how this breaks down, right?
Yeah, I guess the difference is the weapon. Because he was charged with something because he had what was considered to be a deadly weapon, the potential there was greater, the danger was greater than it was with Will Smith. But you're right in that, you know, Will Smith, minutes later, got a standing ovation.
Yes.
Nobody was like, oh, you know, let's cool it with this guy after what he just did. Oh, no. He was just, you know, they were applauding him. He wept a little because, you know, whatever he was feeling at that moment. And it wasn't until later that it came out that, yes, they had considered, but they didn't really consider kicking him out and all of that. So the double standard is absolutely there. I'm not saying that they treated this guy appropriately either.
Right,
I mean, to have tons of people come over and just beat you. You know, Dave Chappelle said something like, it wouldn't have been right to kill him, but he thanked everybody for beating him. And that also is pretty disgusting.
Yeah, here's that audio cut. Here's Dave Chappelle talking about getting tackled at an after party.
And all these years later, last night, sat with them in the studio, and I watched them finish their album. And I couldn't believe they were my friends. Because they're so good at what they do. That album, it's on Luminary right now. You should listen to it. And then I brought him out on stage and tackled me. I felt good when my friends broke his arm. I felt good. How bad does the have to be that John Stewart will stomp him?
Violence is sad in all of its forms. Wow. I'm sure this guy's mentally ill. I'm sure the guy that attacked him is probably not very, is obviously doesn't have all of his faculties, but I don't know how much we should be celebrating violence on top of violence. Yeah. Even though we view it as being justified, whatever that might mean.
Well, I mean, it's one thing to stop the guy from doing anything. And it's a totally other thing to have, you know, what, 15 people versus one person just to beat him. I don't see where that's, you know, that solves anything. I mean, Dave Chappelle was not hurt. What he did was wrong, and he could have hurt him badly with the knife.
Right.
But they got him fast, and they could have gotten him out of there fast. But instead, they did it as like sport.
Right.
I think it's disgusting.
Yeah, and then also it's kind of a weird, very macabre joke to throw in there that Jon Stewart was also kind of engaging in that. It's kind of a making light of kind of mob violence in that way. It's kind of like, I wouldn't do it. But, you know, I guess that's the way that he wants to to process it, I guess. Maybe that's the way he wants to try to convey it to the people around him. Hey, you know, speaking of traumatic events, by the way, Sherry Ellicker, you ever been on a cruise ship? You ever been on a boat with other people that you can't escape from, that you can't leave, that you're just stuck there with your grandparents and you're 13 and all you want to do is be left alone, but they keep telling you that you have to do the luau dancing and all that other stuff?
Yeah, I don't agree with cruises very. I mean, cruises don't agree with me. I've been on a few of them. Never again. I always feel like I'm in isolation, or I always feel like I'm in quarantine when I'm on a cruise when there's no illness, because I just find it to be not my thing at all.
It's a weird social practice that I feel like is from a bygone era that we should get rid of. Cruise lining, cruising in general. It's like, just go to the place that you want to be. But the thing that got me about this yesterday, when I talked about this on my highly rated radio program between 7 and 10, the thing that got me about it was the guy gets on the boat and he agrees to the conditions that Carnival Cruise had for people getting on the boat. And then when he gets COVID, now he is upset about the fact that he agreed to the conditions that Carnival Cruise has on their boats. Do you know what I'm saying? That now he is upset that he agreed to being locked into his room. And he says that that's unfair, even though he agreed to it.
Well,
right?
I think, yes, they all agreed to it. But I think that the part of the issue is the way that they were treated. Like, they said that meals took forever. I mean, but that goes with the territory of cruising in this world when we've got COVID and when more than 100 people on the ship came down with it. I don't know what else they could have done. I mean, they did put some people in hotels and they kept other people on the ship, I guess. I can't imagine. Can you imagine? I mean, it's one thing to be able to get out of that little room on a cruise ship and go about your way and do things wherever you're docked, but to be stuck inside in that tiny little room, especially if you had no windows.
Yeah. And you're with your friend who's now not going to be your friend anymore after 6 days. I mean, there's only so many stories that you can tell.
Yeah.
It's only so many jokes. I mean, I can be really charming for about 3 hours max. And then I get really irritating and really grating because I'm like, hey, what's the deal with light switches? So my read on this, or my approximation of this, is like, I have no sympathy for this guy that we keep hearing in the audio clips. What's his name? It's like David Seifeld or something like that.
I know we have a King 5 piece if you want to play that.
Yeah, Jacob, can we play a little bit of that King 5 piece?
As soon as I tested positive, they told us to pack up everything in our room and wait to be escorted to isolation.
Walter and Carlene Babi live in Texas, but are currently quarantining in a hotel in Linwood. And before that,
we were in quarantine jail on the Spirit for 11 days.
11 days of their 16-day Panama Canal sailing from Miami to Seattle, a cruise interrupted by COVID.
It happened very suddenly and pretty wide.
They say they waited hours for meals and were not properly isolated.
I could reach the galley door from my door without stepping into the hallway. And at times they left it open and people kind of traipsed in and traipsed out. It's
a passenger provided this picture and said this list was posted in plain sight near the elevator.
With my name at the top and his name was second. So they listed everybody's name who had COVID.
Karen Ross, who's now back home in Florida, says her roommate tested positive.
And I said,
yeah, we get
you?
The idea, Jacob. We get the idea. I mean, it's just, this is the thing that's, they're complaining about it, and they're like, we had to be in our rooms for 11 days. It's like, yeah, that's the waiver that you signed before you got on the boat. And they told you to buy insurance, trip insurance, just in case this happened to you. And you went, I'm not going to get COVID-19 in close quarters, surrounded by people high-fiving over Mai Tais at the 24-hour buffet, sneezing into each other's towels out by the pool. That's not going to happen to me. I have no sympathy for any of these people. None whatsoever. This idea that you're like, I'm going to get on a cruise ship and then everything's going to be totally fine in the era of post-COVID. Please. It's like, please spare me all the crying and the whining about how I could have never have I've seen this happen in my life. You signed the waiver. That's what is inevitable will eventually happen. Yes, you signed the waiver. You said, okay, I'll stay in my room if I get COVID-19. And guess what happened? I don't understand why we're even paying attention to these poor people. Explain it to me, Sherry, please. Am I right about this?
I guess it's because COVID hasn't gone away. It's still out there.
Yes.
And so it's one sort of wonders a little bit about the logic of taking a cruise when
exactly.
It's still out there and when these measures are still being exercised. There will be a time, maybe, maybe not, where COVID becomes like any other illness or whatever. I mean, and they won't isolate people necessarily. They'll just tell you to, I don't know, just, you know, take an aspirin, whatever. We're not there yet. There's still quarantines in place, still isolation in place in some of these things. So you're right. If you're going to sign up for that and you're going to take a risk getting on a cruise in that, you know, when those close quarters, sorry. That's what I mean. I feel really bad for people that like this might have been their 50th wedding anniversary,
sure.
or they got married, or you know it's somebody's birthday and they're all getting together for you know somebody's event. I feel terrible that they would be stuck like that. But you know maybe wait a year until this goes away, or we're all dead, or something.
Right.
I don't know.
Or just go to your location, do what I did,
right.
And say, I'm going to go to a resort, so if I do get COVID, I can still walk around and go to the beach and just stay away from people. I used this analogy last night, and I'll use it again. If I'm in my garage hitting bullets with a hammer, and one of those bullets goes off, should I be surprised? Do you know what I mean? If I am doing something irresponsible and then something bad happens, should I be surprised? Absolutely not. That's just what I'm saying.
Speaking of bullets, I want to apologize for being distracted because I've just spent this whole segment looking at photos of this Final Fantasy VIII sword gun.
Yes, yes. Thank you. Thank you.
I just need to know how it works. I don't understand why. Like it.
Okay.
It's crazy.
It doesn't actually.
Does it shoot?
Hey, guys, I'm gonna go put the clothes in the dryer.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
While you do this. Okay.
Listen,
good.
Jacob. In the game, okay. It's you don't actually shoot it. You just it's like more of a sword.
It's
than
decorative. It's an entirely decorative gun piece. Okay,
it's a handle, and then you—that's the way that you do it.
Pretty dumb.
I want to see. How dare you? I want to see. There's got to be somebody in the text line that knows about Final Fantasy VIII and understood that reference. Someone has to know this. All right, Chris Martin. Did you know the reference, Chris Martin? Did you get it?
No, I missed the beginning, and I have no idea what you guys are talking about right now.
I'm so upset.
You just spoke for the rest of the audience, by the way. Thank you for that.
I'm so upset right now. You guys have no idea. Keel Mortgage, proud sponsors of the John Curley, Sherry Elicker Experience, radio program experience, soon with haptic feedback. 1-888-778-KIEL. 5-star reviews, Sherry Elicker, everywhere you go on the internet. I just Googled them really quick. I thought, let me check these guys out. 5-star reviews. 1-888-778-KIEL. Sherry, you ever take out a mortgage? I haven't done that yet in my life. I have no idea that works. I don't know what it is.
Well, the people at Keel Mortgage will talk you through every bit of it, and they'll hold your hand every step of the way. They'll make sure that you get what you need, and you get a really solid understanding of what you're signing.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Sherry. So this is a tricky topic, I think, Sherry. So I'm going to take a step back a little bit on this, but the long and the short of it is that there's a new trend on TikTok, everybody's favorite new social media platform, and basically what people do is they film their maybe their parent or their grandparent who is suffering with dementia, and then they put that on TikTok, and this is generally like 90 seconds to about 2 minutes worth of footage. And, Jacob, we have some audio cuts, but I kind of want to just skip over it because I don't really want to give these horrible people any credit in any kind of light of day. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no. I had the same feeling. I watched through a lot of these examples,
yeah.
And it makes you feel kind of gross, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really conflicted about it. There's something that I think could be valuable for certain people, or maybe if you're going through it and you see someone else dealing with it, that makes you, I don't know, feel like you're not alone. But at the same time, I don't think that's all of the motivation for most of the people posting these. So it is kind of, I agree, kind of gross.
So Sherry, your dad is living with dementia currently, and when we were talking about this in the pre-show meeting, you had some hot and spicy takes about this as someone who actually lives in this world. Would you want to share those with us?
Yeah, so I've never talked about this on the air because my dad's, you know, very private, and so am I to some degree, but I think that this really made an impression on me because when I read about this in the Wall Street Journal about that this particular group of videos have gotten over 2.8 billion views. And that part didn't really surprise me because so many families are dealing with dementia and so many families, you know, have to endure. They may be the number one caregiver. They may not have, you know, a lot of help and they look for support. So I watched these videos with curiosity to try to see if I thought they would be something inspirational or educational for me having a dad that's in the early stages of dementia. And I didn't come to that conclusion at all. I found them to be kind of disturbing. And I think that they exploited some of the people on there. It is a really awful, awful disease. My dad's one of the lucky ones. He's in a tremendous facility. He gets great care. He's got, you know, kids that adore him and help him. He's been married to my mom for 67 years. So he's got the best of all conditions when it comes to having something like this. But it's so painful. You know, my dad worked for NSA for 45 years. He went to Harvard. He went to the National War College. He's a brilliant, brilliant guy. And to watch the decline, it comes on sometimes so suddenly that you're just, you can't even really trace when it started. All of a sudden, you know, they just aren't the same and they don't remember anything, or they have like compulsive activities or things that they do over and over and over again. You can't explain it. Luckily, he still knows who we are and he's not in an advanced stage, but it's definitely there. And when I saw some of these videos of the behavior that they were documenting, I just thought, I don't buy the fact that they are aware that this is being done to them. And I choose those words on purpose because that's what it feels like to me. It feels like they're being victimized. It feels like they are doing it for just to get views or so somebody can be a little bit more famous on TikTok. And I agree with Jacob. It's gross. I would never do that. I just don't think that it's the right thing to do. And I don't know how you really get a whole lot of comfort or support in a 90-second video of somebody not remembering how to sing.
Right.
I'm sorry. That's just pain. That's just, you know, pain and sadness in action. And I don't want to ever see them again.
Right. I think it's a boundaries thing, Sherry. I think I just figured it out. Because you just outlined kind of the overarching theme of what you were saying is, I have all these great boundaries with my dad and with my siblings and with my mom and with this facility. And it's like really healthy boundaries. And these Zoomers, apparently, and some of these millennials, unfortunately, have really bad boundaries. I guess it's almost like if I were to film arguments that I have with Sarah and then put those on the internet and ask people to comment on them, right? Or like when Sarah's father passed away, if I were to have filmed that in the hospital and then put it on the internet, it's really gross. And yet so many people out there just have bad boundaries, like bad interpersonal boundaries, and they go, oh yeah, no, I'll get all kinds of support for putting this on the internet.
Well, and I think that there's a whole group of people, there's a subculture of people that do get something out of it.
Yeah.
It's not me, it may not be you, but I think that because people are so obsessed with TikTok and that's where they get their news, that's where they think their friends are, it's that connection that they have that I can't relate to at all. But it may work for them. But I just don't think documenting someone's illness or decline or anything, and putting it out there in, you know, 45 seconds or 90 second little clips of anything accomplishes much. I really don't. If you want to document something before your loved one gets to the point where their memory is completely gone or they're incapacitated, then do that for the family, right? I mean, do that as a way to preserve some of what they have left. But to put it on TikTok, I mean, at the very least, it's tacky.
Very tacky. And like, even just looking at the thumbnails that are part of the TikTok videos, I was like, oh wow, this is gross. Like, I feel like I'm invading somebody else's world in so many ways, even though they're offering it up. Sherry, I got to tell you the story about when somebody asked me to make a documentary about a man who was being released from prison and why I turned down tens of thousands of dollars in order to not make this documentary. I got to tell you this story.
Oh, I want to hear that.
That's
wow.
A great story. So maybe we'll talk about Dave Chappelle, or maybe we'll talk about the time that I turned down thousands of dollars right. In order to not do a documentary. So.
Wait, I just got to know before you tell the story. Yeah. Regret it or happy about your decision?
So happy. So the happiest I've ever been is not taking that video assignment. All right. So, Sherry, when I was 28 years old, I was a burgeoning young director in the world of film. And I was referred to a woman who wanted to make a documentary about a man who was being released from prison. Now, this woman had money to burn. She was a social worker by choice. She was came from a lot of money, and she was also just happened to be a social worker and a paralegal. And I met with this woman over dinner, and she was very, very excited to make a documentary about a man who was one of her clients. He had been imprisoned in the state of California when he was 18 years old. When he was 17 years old, this is back in the 70s, he and his buddies kidnapped a young lady, held her for ransom, did awful things to her, and then threatened to murder her before dumping her in the Tenderloin District in San Francisco, California. They were caught, and he was given life in prison when he turned 18. And California that year had passed a law in which for those prisoners, for those people who were inmates, they were going to review their sentencing. So if you had committed a crime when you were 17 and then you were sentenced when you were 18, they were going to review this. So there was a possibility that this guy was going to get out. And he had been in prison for the better part of like 35, 40 years. He had never seen snow. He hadn't had a cheeseburger in that number of years. It was all this stuff. So I meet with this woman, and she's kind of a portly woman. She is very kind of overly excitable, very giddy, asking me lots of technical questions that she didn't need to know about. And she says, I want to film him leaving the prison, and I want to film me taking him to the mountains to see snow and seeing his siblings who he hasn't seen in 30 or 40 years. And I'm thinking, like, okay, like, cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching. I'm just literally just, like, cash registers are going off in my brain as to how expensive this is going to be. And I want drone shots of him standing in Yosemite, and I'm just thinking, money, 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 money. And then the conversation takes a really weird turn. She gets really, really quiet. She goes, can I tell you something else? I go, yeah. She says, I love this man. This man and I have developed a relationship. Thomas and I have decided that we're going to get married when he is released. Over the last 10 years, we have discovered that we have the same love language. He likes gifts and I like gifts. We like the same colors. We like the same things. And I want you to film me marrying this man. And we'll feature it at the end of the documentary. And then we'll release it. And I know that you're going to win tons of awards for this. And I went, I'm going to have to think about this. So basically what she wanted me to do is she wanted me to like film her romance with this guy. And so when I was going back over it in my mind, she wanted me to film them meeting when he was released from prison, them going to the snow together, them eating cheeseburgers together. She wanted me to film their relationship effectively and then cut it into a quote-unquote documentary. And she was going to pay me tens of thousands of dollars to do this. And I turned it down. I said, absolutely not. I will not exploit that man for other people's entertainment and for your own enjoyment. It just seemed to be so perverse to me, this idea that this man, who basically had the coping skills of a child, he had been in prison since he was 18 years old, it just felt so exploitative to me that I just said, I can't morally do that to the man, because there are circumstances which I am sure that both he and you want to have privacy. So, for as an example, the first time he, touches grass when he gets out of prison, I don't want to film a full-grown man crying like a small child. It just felt too invasive and too much, so I turned it down, Sherry. That's that story.
Yeah, I don't blame you. And not only that, but it's like, what is she doing? Like,
yes, if you want to
do, you know, if you want to make a love letter to him, then do something different. Like the two of you, wow, let's do a vacation video or something like that. But to make it like he's a newborn baby discovering ice cream or something, and she's there to witness this because she is his hero. Ew, I don't blame you. Good for you.
Thank you.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah. You know, when I worked in the prison system, I love to say that sentence. That whenever you see, like, on Dateline and you see them interviewing an inmate or something like that, that was my department that I had to approve or not approve that kind of media access. I turned down every single request for that very reason.
Good.
I thought it exploited people. I thought it was unfair. And I thought all we're doing is making money for 2020 and Dateline and all of those shows. And I thought it was wrong. I thought it was completely wrong.
Yeah, and not only that, but like, if she had told me in the beginning, this is our relationship vlog, I would have been a little bit more, I could have said, no, I'm not going to do that. But the fact that she backloaded it and then said, oh, by the way, we're getting married and we're gonna love each other and all this other stuff. I was like, no, I can't do it.
Now, you're sure she doesn't, she's not in like working in the prison system now and just escape with another inmate like the, you don't think that's her, do you?
No.
Okay,
that's
good.
It's not
okay.
Cabbage Patch Lady. hey, Chris Martin, what do you think of my documentary? Would you have taken it or would you have turned it down?
I think you made the right move.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate it, sir.